Welcome to the Legal Aid New South Wales Criminal Law Division podcast. The Criminal Law Division of Legal Aid New South Wales acknowledges the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as the traditional custodians of the land and waters. We acknowledge this podcast is recorded on Aboriginal land and pay our respect to elders past and present. We extend that respect to First Nations listeners joining us here today.
We're recording today on Gadigal land. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land and pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and any First Nations colleagues who may be listening today. My name is Matt Dimmick. I'm the Manager of Professional Development for the Criminal Law Division at Legal Aid New South Wales. This podcast is being recorded to assist the many lawyers who are likely only now just coming across the expanded Child Sexual Offence Evidence Program. As we shall discuss, this program changes the way trial courts will deal with certain sexual offences involving children witnesses. To discuss, we have invited three senior lawyers from Legal Aid New South Wales to talk about their knowledge and experience of the program. We have Helen Shaw, Senior Solicitor in our Indictables 2 team, Nguyen Ngo from our High Risk Offenders Unit, and Leanne Mellor from our Newcastle Criminal Law team. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
To set up some of the background, I'll turn to you first, Nguyen. What legislation ought lawyers be familiar with when working under the program?
Lawyers should be familiar with the District Court Practice Note 28, which outlines the listing procedures and the filing requirements of the parties. The relevant legislation is found in Criminal Procedure Act Division 1A. The relevant sections there are sections 294E to 294S, and lawyers should also be aware of the definition within that Act of a prescribed sexual offences.
With respect to the prescribed sexual offences, which of those would the program apply to?
The program applies to prescribed sexual offences which are heard in the district court, and they involve complainants or prosecution witnesses which are under the age of 18 at the time of committal for trial of the accused. So often in cases involving child sex offences, we find that there are multiple offences that have been charged, and it's important to know that if one offence is captured via the definition of the prescribed sexual offences, the entirety of the matter is put into the program.
People should really carefully look at the definition of prescribed sexual offence. Because it's quite a broad definition, there are a number of offences captured by that. It's not just child sexual assault matters. It also includes other offences involving the abuse of children. So one that springs to mind and isn't immediately apparent is section 43B, which is the failure to reduce or remove risk of a child becoming a victim of child abuse, as well as the prohibitions against female genital mutilation.
And how is child defined?
So a child is defined as a person under the age of 18. They may be aged 18 or over at the time of the trial, but if they were under 18 at the time the accused was committed for trial or a sentence, then they may come under this program.
And when did the program commence?
The original pilot commenced in 2016 and operated in Sydney and Newcastle District Courts. That program has now expanded in all jurisdictions over the New South Wales District Courts as at the 29th of January 2024. It's important to note that this does not change the process for existing proceedings in Sydney and Newcastle District Court. It does not change the existing orders for proceedings or matters that have already been set down elsewhere.
So I'll open this question up to all of you. How does the program change the processes for child sexual offence matters?
The first obvious change is the way in which children give their evidence in court. Their evidence is pre-recorded in a separate hearing without the jury and then played in the trial proper. And that evidence is largely the cross-examination, whereas their evidence in chief will often largely be the pre-recorded JURT interview.
Another major change is the introduction of witness intermediaries, which are appointed by the court for child complainants and child witnesses. and that person, the witness intermediary, who will explain a bit later, is present in the remote room while the child is giving evidence, and they're visible to the jury in that video recording, and the lawyers are meant to follow their guidelines as to how to phrase questions to those child witnesses.
Leanne, you mentioned that the child's evidence in chief is mainly presented by way of the JURT interview. What matters essentially are contained within the pre-record hearing?
So the pre-record may involve the Crown calling some further evidence in chief, but largely pre-recording is the cross-examination by defence. And it's really important to note that that is really expected to be the one and only time that the child would be cross-examined. So that if there was a need to conduct further cross-examination, it requires an application for leave, putting on a notice of motion, an affidavit in support of that. And it's only in rare circumstances that that would be granted.
In terms of the witness intermediary, what is their involvement in the proceedings aside from being there whilst the child's giving evidence?
The court makes an order to appoint a witness intermediary for a child. It might be the complainant or another child who is a prosecution witness. And the witness intermediary will be asked to prepare a report, an assessment of that child, and that report gets sent to the court with a list of recommendations about that child's particular communication needs. And then prior to the cross-examination of that child beginning, either the practice note says a week before, but it might be on the same day, but prior to that cross-examination recording, the witness intermediary gives their ground rules, which is them listing, reading out in essence, their recommendations for how to phrase or not to phrase certain questions.
Ewan, can you talk further as to the role of the witness intermediary in the process? Are they there to assist the prosecution, or what other function do they play in the trial?
The witness intermediary is not there to assist only parties in the proceeding, but their main role is to communicate to the court the understanding of the questions being put to the child witnesses. So that includes prosecution witnesses, and it also includes the complainant. They are there to explain the best way to ask questions and to provide a written report, as Helen has mentioned earlier, about the communication based on that child's needs. They have a duty to be impartial and to facilitate that communication of and with the witness, with a view for that witness to give their best evidence.
How do you get appointed a witness intermediary?
They have to undergo training and appointment to a panel, and victim services conduct that training and the appointment of those persons. And there have to be tertiary qualifications in psychology, social work, speech pathology, teaching or occupational therapy. And this is under section 294M of the Criminal Procedure Act. And they may also have other qualifications, training or experience as prescribed by regulations.
Now, Leanne, I'm going to turn to you to discuss some of the early considerations that a solicitor would have in respect of a child sexual offence evidence program matter. So if I'm a solicitor who's first picked up one of these matters, what should I be aware of in the early stages of these proceedings?
It might sound quite obvious, but the first is actually realising that a pre-record hearing is likely. So it's really important to be turning your mind upon receiving a new allocation to the questions of whether it involves a prescribed sexual offence and whether or not any of the complainants or witnesses are children under the age of 18 years, keeping in mind that the relevant time is at the time of the committal, not the date of the alleged offence. Another important thing to consider is involving counsel and briefing counsel as early as possible. The practical reality is that in legal aid matters, counsel can't be briefed until the point of charge certification. But start talking to PDs or counsel early, because as soon as you can brief, things start moving quickly. The practice note dictates the need for counsel to be at early listings, and your counsel will need availability within the early months of being briefed to prep and appear in the pre-record hearing. Another factor is being really ready for the case conference and turning your mind earlier and more urgently to what material you will need for the pre-record hearing. Is the Crown getting the school records or medical records, for example? What might you need to subpoena? Will SACCP provisions apply, and will you need to make a leave application? Remembering too that if SACCP is at play, these subpoenas can only be issued once you're in the district court, and that time period is now smaller with the pre-recording of evidence. Another consideration on the same area is whether or not there are aids or exhibits that will assist in the pre-record. Things such as a history of addresses, an age chart, and or a chronology of schools, and perhaps a plan of a house if an offence occurred within a house. These are things that we then need to pull together really quickly and have ready for the pre-record. Additionally, you clearly need to have some procedural knowledge of some of the areas that were spoken about earlier. Familiarise yourself with the practice note and the relevant amendments to the Criminal Procedure Act that have already been outlined. The most important issue will be around your geographical location and how the practice note operates to the area where you are practicing. Procedures differ depending on whether you're at Sydney District Court, one of the Sydney West District Courts, or a regional court, and then different again if you're in a circuit court. Additionally, I expect local practices to develop. For example, in Newcastle today, ground rule hearings are conducted on the morning of the pre-record hearing instead of a week before, as that has been the most practical approach, given that we had visiting pre-record hearing judges for fixed sittings. Whether or not courts adopt that approach might depend on the practical considerations, and the practice note leaves some room for that. Finally, there's the need to be mindful of where these matters sit in your practice and that the time that they require. Pre-record hearing procedures speed up and front load the trial prep. Pre-record hearing is regarded as day one of the trial, so you need to be fully prepped and ready as though the whole matter is going to trial. But then there is further work before the trial proper, reviewing and agreeing on edits of the pre-record evidence, and then preparing again for the trial proper. All solicitors who've participated in the pilot have generally commented that they find that these matters take additional time and fall in a different place within their practice.
So it sounds that lawyers who are picking up these matters need to be cognizant of the fact that they're probably going to get really busy once the matter's in the district court, and or take that into account when picking up other matters or reviewing their practice.
That's exactly right.
So if I am a lawyer who's picking up one of these program matters, aside from these differences in process, what should I be advising my client of that I might not have under the previous scheme?
I find that it's really important to clearly advise your client how the trial will run and dispel any misconceptions around either usual trial procedure or the differences with pre-record hearings. So some of this is areas that we've touched on already, but explaining to your client that a pre-record hearing is conducted differently and separately to the trial proper, that the child gives their evidence remotely via CCTV with a witness intermediary present, and what the role of the witness intermediary is, what sort of things will be in their report, the limitations on the styles of questions that can be asked, but also explaining to clients that these are good practices for cross-examining children. Evidence in chief is the JURT interview, as we discussed earlier, which won't be played at the pre-record hearing. The child may give some short evidence and then be cross-examined by our counsel. So that makes it really important that the client understands the evidence that's being presented, but also is well across the contents of that JURT interview. I would explain to the client that when we do get to the trial proper, we will impanel a jury, and the JURT and the pre-recording hearing will both be played at that point in time, and explain to the client that the child usually wouldn't give evidence again. This is a significant difference so that the client understands why things are broken up in the way they will and how that will then play out later. Personally, I tell my clients that whilst this might seem a bit unfair, and we certainly thought that when we first rolled out the pilot sites. We've been doing this now in the pilot sites for a number of years. We're getting used to the process. Solicitors and counsel have learnt to work within it. It means we get started quickly, and I tell them that it means we give their matter a lot of early attention. And that often the playing field around fairness is evened up because there is an artificiality of the fact that the jury never sees a witness live in the courtroom. So I think it's important that clients have a really strong understanding of the differences, but why they're in place.
So while we're talking about fairness, it's important to note that the witness intermediary cannot give an opinion about the accuracy of a witness's recall of the facts in a case, nor can they give an opinion about whether or not a witness is telling the truth in their evidence. Their role is strictly limited to facilitate the communication during a witness's evidence only.
So really important to advise your client that whilst the witness intermediary is there, they're not there to provide any kind of opinion to the court about the evidence that's being given.
That's correct.
And they are neutral. In the past, under the legislation, they were called children's champions. That terminology is absolutely abandoned in the practice note and everything like that. So they are not the champion of anybody. They are neutral. They're not against the accused.
Going back to something Leanne said earlier, Leanne noted that the content of the pre-record hearing is predominantly the child being cross-examined by counsel for the defence, and that if there was anything that the defence wished to cross-examine that child witness on that wasn't covered in that pre-record hearing, there would need to be a notice of motion filed and leave sought to cross-examine that child witness again. Have any of you had a situation where you've had to seek to recall that child witness to further cross-examine them?
Yes, I have. And firstly, go and look at the legislation, section 294K, Criminal Procedure Act, and look at the practice note which emphasises this. The court must not give leave under subsection 1 unless the court is satisfied that A, the party has become aware of a matter which the party could not reasonably have been aware at the time of the recording, or B, it is otherwise in the interests of justice to give leave. To seek leave, you need to do a notice of motion and an affidavit in support, and you need to obviously file and serve that. And there may be legal argument. You may have to argue this if the DPP oppose you having permission to further cross-examine the child witness. And an example that I had in an early case, which was still part of the pilot early on in Sydney District Court, was the complainant had made 3 JURT interviews with police. So our original cross-examination was based on 3 JURTs and other relevant portions of the brief. And after the pre-record cross-examination, which really went to issues of her posting online that her age was above the age of consent, above the age of 16, giving rise to our client's honest and reasonable belief about her age being above the age of consent, and also that she was consenting. She was cross-examined on aspects that, you know, went to the heart of our client's defence. And after the pre-recorded cross-examination, we were served with a 4th JURT interview of her by police, and also a statement from her father, which contained an allegation of a conversation which apparently raised for the first time ever, certainly not in his first statement 18 months earlier, that he had had a conversation with my client about his daughter being under the age of 16. Because this 4th JURT raised issues which we could not have foreseen, and it certainly wasn't raised in the first 3, we had to seek leave, which meant I had to do an affidavit in support of a notice of motion seeking leave to further cross-examine her on that 4th JURT. And then luckily we did get leave, because if we didn't get permission, you can imagine that 4th JURT would have got played to the jury and we would have had no chance to challenge it in any way. It would have just gone in, played to the jury, and it would have been devastating to my client's defence. Ultimately, he was found not guilty, but certainly was in the interests of justice to allow him to have her cross-examined again. And we had to do that prior to the date of the jury empanelment and the rest of the trial. So we had to squeeze that further cross-examination in with witness intermediary again before the rest of the trial started.
So your example, Helen, really does demonstrate not only the high bar that must be met in order to recall a witness, a child witness, but also the importance of being across the entirety of the material against your client. In that instance, it clearly was in the interest of justice that leave be granted.
Absolutely. If it was just a case of having that information already and us forgetting to ask some questions or us failing to read parts of the brief that didn't help us and then realising we haven't put something to the complainant, I doubt we would have got leave.
And I guess that emphasises the importance of being fully instructed and across that material. So are there additional or different issues that a lawyer should consider whilst getting instructions on a matter that's subject to the program?
Again, it goes back to something that Leanne said, you know, be fully across all the instructions on the entire brief, not just the child's interviews, but across any other versions that they may have given to some adult complainants or other children witnesses, and so have all those instructions and be ready to put those cross-examination questions to the child based on everything else that's in the brief.
The key things I would mention is making sure that you've had the opportunity before the pre-record hearing to view the actual video footage of the JERD interview. It's one of the practical difficulties in these matters that we're not served with that material and we're only served with a transcript. So I would recommend that people get in touch with a DPP solicitor with carriage at the earliest opportunity to make arrangements to view that material. Most often that's facilitated by the material being uploaded to the portal and requiring you to complete the sensitive evidence access form. It's also really important that you make sure you get access for counsel and you confirm that that access works. No one wants dramas where counsel's trying to prep outside office hours and can't get access. I'd also recommend trying to negotiate access for as long as possible. Sometimes that access is very time limited and it's not always practical for the preparation of matters or needing to return to issues. So if you are only offered a small window, I would recommend making inquiries about extending that period of time and perhaps seeking access up until the trial date.
Is there anything else I should be raising with the prosecutor at that earlier stage of the proceedings?
Trying to deal with pre-trial issues, trying to resolve those pre-trial issues as early as possible. Anything from trying to sever an indictment, separate trials, tenancy issues, things like that. Try to resolve, or your judge alone trial, try to resolve things as early as possible.
I've sometimes found it's also a good idea to just talk in the case conference about whether this is a pre-record matter. I suspect it will be less common now that it's rolled out and more of a regular occurrence. But it has been the case that the DPP haven't always turned their mind to those issues, and discussing it in the case conference, you're able to make sure that everybody's on the same page and have a think about what the estimate for the pre-record hearing will be, because you will be asked about that quite quickly.
And I suspect that would make the process of the ground rules hearing a lot smoother and quicker as well, right?
It might do, although a lot of the ground rules hearing is around the questions that can be asked and the recommendations of the witness intermediary.
Are there any other issues that solicitors should be aware of when preparing one of these matters at the early stage?
The pre-record hearing is regarded as the first day of trial. That's really important. So client will be arraigned, the charges read out, entering the pleas of not guilty. Indeed, if they are pleading not guilty, then trial has commenced. So, you know, if the client is wavering on any pleas after they've already been committed for trial in the district court, they've really got to enter those pleas if they're going to plead guilty to something sooner the better, because of the EAGP discounts. You know, less than 2 weeks before trial, you're only going to get 5% discount. More than 2 weeks before trial, 10% discount. But with this practice note, you are in the district court faster than the other sorts of matters going from local court to district court.
I've already raised it a couple of times, but around the early briefing of counsel, I think that's something that's quite important. And I just note that we walk a bit of a fine line between early briefing grants criteria, but also ensuring that counsel remains available. And sometimes there can be risks to briefing too early and counsel then is unavailable when the court is trying to set pre-record dates. We've often experienced situations where we need to rebrief quickly or after a pre-record hearing but before the trial due to availability issues. And obviously that's never ideal. I recommend that people have frank conversations with counsel about availability, including making it clear from the outset that this matter is a pre-record hearing matter and the need for additional availability in the early days. And I'd also just suggest to people that, particularly in the early days, bear in mind that counsel may not immediately realise that additional availability that is required around pre-records. Another factor to bear in mind with counsel is the differences in practice in different geographical areas and making sure that your counsel is aware of your local area and what the differences are.
In terms of briefing counsel, what are the expectations that we would place on counsel when managing a CSOEP matter?
Much of the usual expectations around being ready for a case conference. So counsel are now quite used to that front loading of work and being ready. But there is additional requirements in the practice notes around counsel availability to attend mentions and callovers, as well as just being available during those windows of time when the pre-record hearing will be set, so that they don't come into a matter at case conference but then immediately become unavailable.
Another matter that solicitors should be aware of relates to surrounding the time in which you receive the witness intermediary report. In that time frame, solicitors should be thinking about the possible exhibits or having discussions with the prosecution as to what exhibits will be tendered during the pre-record. And those relate to, for example, based on the report about the child's needs. For example, there have been matters where exhibits come across in visual form to cater to a child's understanding of time concepts. Certainly, we see them in matters where there are multiple offences and matters in which cover across decades or years in terms of the alleged offending. Those discussions are particularly important to have with the prosecution and with counsel as well, so that by the time you reach the pre-recorded hearing, it will run a lot smoother in terms of referencing certain offences, certain time periods, when asking the questions of the complainant or the child witness.
And just on that point, we are invited and welcomed to discuss with the witness intermediary their recommendations and to check with them whether our questions in cross-examination are in compliance with or infringe their guidelines, their rules. Because the last thing that you want when you are in the middle of cross-examining a child witness is to have the witness intermediary on the video putting their hand up and suggesting or accusing you of breaking the rules. It will just disrupt the flow and it will annoy the witness intermediary, probably annoy the judge and certainly frustrate the counsel. So we are actively encouraged to contact or speak with the witness intermediary either at court or before court about the recommendations and whether our questions and, example, those diagrams or some other sort of material is suitable for that child's communication requirements.
Tagging on from that, the access to envelopes and exhibits is often very important in pre-record matters. At some courts, we're really lucky to have access to great remote witness facilities and the assistance of sheriff to move material back and forth between those rooms. But that won't be the experience everywhere, particularly in circuit and regional courts. I just raise that there might be a need for flexibility, but before consenting to ad hoc arrangements for remote witness facilities, that people should make sure that there are plans in place for things like provision of access to envelopes, privacy and camera angles, and making sure that there's not other items in the room or other things that might potentially distract or prejudice a jury.
Are there any other considerations a solicitor should have when managing a child sexual offence evidence program matter?
We've touched on editing and the amount of editing that's required. These matters require more editing than other matters where, you know, often we have to edit an accused's ERISP for various reasons, relevance, prejudice, admissibility. But with these matters, we have to look at the JURT or multiple JURTs, look at editing. Then we also, they are edited before the pre-record, and then we have to edit the pre-record video and transcript. And a lot of what's edited out is the judge's comments and conversation with the child before the cross-examination gets underway. So there's no extra sympathy or prejudice involved. So there's a lot of editing that gets done, and we have to check, it's on us to check that the video that the DPP has access to but we don't is edited correctly and appropriately, and that the edited video matches the edited transcript. So again, you need to apply for the link from the DPP, signing the sensitive evidence document, and get enough time to be able to double check that everything matches, because the last thing you want is to be in the Court of Criminal Appeal because something has been shown to the jury which shouldn't have been. And keep in mind also that the jury gets played those edited versions of the JURT, edited pre-recorded cross-examination and re-examination, and it's very important that we put time into the day. And sometimes you're looking at this at night time. It's very labour-intensive, these matters. They're long hours, outside court hours, to get this right.
Now, turning to the pre-recorded evidence hearing, Helen, with respect to that part of the proceedings, is there anything in particular a solicitor should be mindful of when preparing for that?
So we've touched on some of this, but it is worth saying again. The accused will be arraigned at that pre-record date. So the indictment will be read out to them. They'll have to enter their pleas, we're assuming not guilty pleas, on that date. So tell the client that, prepare them for that. The pre-recorded evidence hearing is part of the trial. It's in fact the first day of trial, but it's done in the absence of the jury. The judge presiding over the pre-recorded evidence hearing may or may not be the same judge as the part of the trial with the jury. And different regional areas, Newcastle, Sydney metropolitan areas, they may have different experiences with that. But I certainly have had trials where the judge doing the pre-record was different to the judge in front of the jury, and it may even be a female voice on the pre-record, a male voice in front of the jury, and it's just, jury's just told, don't worry about this, this is perfectly normal. Yeah, they're given a direction about that. The JURT, or interview with police, again, is the evidence in chief of the child witness, and that will not be played in court before the cross-examination begins. A witness intermediary, who we will already have received a report from about the child's communication skills, will be sitting in the remote room with the child witness as the child gives evidence. And if there's an interpreter required for the child, there will also be an interpreter in that remote room able to be seen and heard on the video. There may be a support person in the room with the child, but that person will not be seen or heard, but their presence and name will be advised to us. The accused can see and hear the witness intermediary and child witness on screen, but importantly, the accused will be positioned in the dock of the courtroom in a place where they cannot be seen by the child witness. So the court officer will test the cameras and they will position the accused in the dock in a spot that they have worked out so that the child cannot see them. The court will be closed and there will be a non-publication order on the child's name. There may or may not be a non-publication order on the accused's name. It really can depend on whether the accused is related to the child or not. Some accused, obviously, they want their name non-published, but that's not automatic. The Crown prosecutor may have a couple of questions for the child witness, some diagrams, photos, drawings, maps, etc. Those things might be tendered by the prosecutor, but other than that, the bulk of that pre-record hearing is, of course, as we've said, it's the cross-examination. That's the focus of the pre-record hearing.
And now turning to the balance of the trial, so we've completed the pre-record evidence hearing. How does the program, if at all, change the approach to the balance of the trial? Is there anything that you're doing differently than what you would be doing in a non-program matter?
Again, go back to that, all that editing that you have to do. So you may also have, depending on the way of pre-trial applications like tenancy notice and stuff like that, that will come after the pre-record hearing. That may dictate how your accused's ERISP is edited or not edited, depending on, you know, whether there are separate trials, severed indictments, etc., tendency notice in or out, that sort of thing. So all that editing of your own client's ERISP and the JURTs, that will all happen after the pre-record hearing, and it's very labour-intensive.
And I suppose that raises those issues about accessing the material from the pre-record hearing as well and the transcript and such, right?
Yes, it can take a while. Some courts are, transcript branches of courts are faster than others. It took several months for us to receive our last pre-record cross-examination transcript, and we have to advise what edits we want when we do our defence notice, defence response to the notice of prosecution case. You're meant to indicate what edits and things like that you want. So if you don't have that document prior to having to serve your notice, I just put edits to be advised once the pre-trial applications are resolved.
And then moving forward, when you then move on to the balance of the trial, what other considerations does a solicitor have to have?
Depending on how many child witnesses, whether they're complainants or other witnesses, there are a good bulk of the beginning of the trial in front of the jury might be taken up with playing of video recordings. Example, the JURT or multiple JURTs and cross-examination videos. So there can be sometimes days of playing videos. And so that you actually know the actual time of that part of the trial because you have the length of time on a video. So that can be, in one sense, you can say, look, there's going to be 1.5 hours or 3 days of videos being played. Something that can happen, though, is that when a jury asks a question and they want to have the child's cross-examination replayed, it may be the case that the judge orders that that be done in the courtroom, video played with the jury and the legal representatives in the courtroom watching it. The judge may not allow the jury to do that in the jury room. Some judges may, but I've had it where we had to sit there in real time, live, watching again the video of cross-examination. Because the video is the evidence, not the transcript. And that's one of the directions that the court always gives, that for any trial, that the video, whether it's the ERISP or a JURT or cross-examination pre-recording, the evidence is the video, what the jury hears, and if there's any difference between what the jury thinks they've heard on the video as to compared to the transcript, they are to go with what they hear, what they believe they've heard, rather than what's on the transcript. The transcript is an aide memoir. It's not the evidence. So we're hauled into court to watch and listen to that evidence again in real time, which then raises another issue where you probably need to seek a direction from the judge about weight given to something that's repeated in court. It doesn't make it more true because they're hearing it again. So there has to be some care that too much weight is not placed on the child's evidence in chief or cross-examination.
Touching on something that Helen was saying around directions and changes of voices, I think it's really important to turn your mind to what the jury do actually see once we get to the trial proper. That we've spent many months in a bit of a disjointed way having pre-record hearings and returning to evidence, that it's what the jury see is simply a video of the child giving their evidence and being cross-examined. They don't see a video of the internals of the courtroom at the time that that happened. So they don't see counsel, they don't see the judge, they just hear voices. It's really important that they understand who's talking and that they're not unnecessarily perplexed by trying to work out who's who. Helen touched on the example of when the judge changes and that the gender of the judge may change. There have also quite regularly been issues around changes in counsel at both ends of the bar table. Unfortunately, that can be quite common given the time periods that these matters can travel across and can create not only continuity issues around the way the matter is run, but also the pre-recorded material. So if the jury is just hearing a voice and then those participants change to the people they see in the courtroom, there's confusion. I can think of a particular example where there was a need for an ad hoc direction by the judge about who the different participants were. At the pre-record hearing, a female trial advocate was asking questions. Her voice was quite distinctive as well because she was sick and losing her voice. That was causing some level of confusion even at the pre-record hearing. But then when we got to the trial proper, a male Crown was briefed in the matter. So there's that need for the jury not to be unnecessarily thinking and trying to understand that there sometimes just does need to be an ad hoc direction to resolve it.
Thanks for all of that information. I think that'll be really helpful for our lawyers when working on one of these program matters. But I'm really interested to know, just as a way of concluding, how you've all found the program to work. Has it significantly changed the way that you've approached working on these matters, and how do you feel about the program moving forward, given that it's expanding across the state?
I think we've all raised the issue of workload and that these matters do involve a lot of work, and they do have some issues behind them that are really time consuming but also important to understand and get across. I do have to say that in Newcastle, we have had an approach, generally speaking, where we've gotten used to the pre-recording of evidence. We've gotten used to the procedures, perhaps because we're lucky to have a relatively small bar and people are well across how these matters run and experienced, that with time there is a more natural approach to it, and it's not as concerning as people might have initially thought.
I agree with that. I think what's most important is being aware and being across all the extra time that a person will need to allocate to administrative tasks and more case management. But overall, the program achieves what it intends to do in that it reduces the experience of a complainant or a child witnesses in terms of their court experience.
And as a final note, the introduction of the witness intermediary, how have you found working with the witness intermediaries in these matters?
I can think of a recent matter that I was involved in which we found the witness intermediary to be particularly helpful, in the sense that counsel and I worked together towards putting together a list of questions into a document and having the witness intermediary review those questions to see whether or not they fell within the appropriate needs of the child, and receiving feedback in order for us to make the appropriate adjustments or appropriate suggestions or take on board what he or she has said that we should direct or formulate our questions in a particular way so that the child can understand the questions that are being put to them and provide their best evidence in terms of answering those questions. It's certainly encouraged by both parties, both the Crown and Defence, to utilise the witness intermediary in that way. Certainly, it hasn't been a practice which is uniform across all matters, but certainly in the matters that I have been involved in, it has been particularly helpful to utilise the services of the witness intermediary in that manner. And certainly I would encourage lawyers and solicitors to think about having those discussions with counsel and whether or not you would approach, particularly in terms of your matter, if that would be something that would be helpful to engage in.
The court, from my experience at callover, the judge conducting the callover has referred us to the advocatesgateway.org, which is a UK website, keeping in mind that the introduction of witness intermediaries commenced in the UK, and we've really adopted this from the UK. And when this first became introduced into New South Wales, one of the UK persons involved came and did training at both the DPP, and I certainly went over to the DPP offices as to learn what the changes were going to be once the pilot was implemented. So that's the advocatesgateway.org, and there are lots of resources on there. If you have any questions, reach out to a colleague. These matters have been conducted in this way in Newcastle and Sydney District Court for many years now, since it was a pilot. So reach out to us and we're happy to discuss as needs be.
And just as a way of finishing up, are there any practical issues which any of you have faced in program matters that might be of interest to our audience? How have those practical issues been resolved?
So one of the issues that I've been noticing is that we spoke earlier about the JURT not being played in court during the pre-record hearing, but the complainant does need to see that and revisit it before they're called to give their evidence and cross-examined. So the practical reality of that is that they are often seeing it quite shortly before the pre-record hearing. It can sometimes cause a complainant to give a further statement to clarify issues or change their version. And then that's served on you either immediately before the pre-record hearing or very close in time to it. An example that's arisen in my practice is a matter where we had the date range significantly extended on the morning of the pre-record hearing. The situation was that we couldn't proceed on that day to pre-record because of the extended date range and the impact that had on preparation and the risk that there would be a need for a further cross-examination to occur. So the decision was made by all parties that the better course was to hold the pre-record at a later date so that preparation could occur. Another practical issue that's arisen in my practice is remembering that when there is a fitness issue for your client, that a pre-record hearing may still be conducted during the special hearing. So that I've had matters where once the client is found to be unfit, the special hearing is conducted by first having pre-recorded hearing of the child's evidence and then a judge alone special hearing, so that it might still arise in those circumstances. And it's something that we need to think about, is that witness intermediaries might be of assistance to defendants as well. Some consideration should be given to whether a witness intermediary might assist. One of the issues will be funding and where you find a witness intermediary for a defendant, but it's certainly been raised that that's something that happens in other jurisdictions and might be something that could assist our clients.
Police may contact a witness intermediary or contact victim services who manage the witness intermediaries to call a witness intermediary to the police station or the office where the JURT interview of the complainant or other child witness is being conducted. There is nothing wrong or undue about that, but it may be the case that a witness intermediary is already involved in the matter from that early stage. And again, keeping in mind that the role of the witness intermediary is not to take a version of events from a witness, it is to facilitate communication. And at the police station, their role would be exactly like it is in court, except they won't be producing a written report. They would be assessing the child and determining what communication needs that child may have and advise police on certain aspects or tips or recommendations on that child's particular communication needs. While I'm on that topic of communication needs, one of my matters involved a child whose first language was not English, and a recommendation by the witness intermediary was that we were to use first names of people, not he or she. And the reason for that was because in the child's first language, there was no distinction between he and she. So to avoid any confusion as to who the questioner was asking about, we were asked to use first names. And that's something that was specific to that child. It won't be a recommendation for somebody else where that's not an issue, but that's again something that may be recommended. That's a type of tailored recommendation that witness intermediaries can provide to facilitate communication and to get less confusion from evidence.
I'd like to thank Helen, Nguyen and Leanne for contributing to today's podcast recording, and I hope the audience have learned a lot about the program and how it will apply to their practice moving forward.